Downloads of the show are available at Podomatic.com or the Podomatic mobile app. Hey, kids. You are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this show is Fish Out of Agua with Michelle Carlo. Today is Tuesday, September 18, 2018. By the time you hear this, summer is almost going to be over. Yep, the fall equinox happens on Saturday the 22nd. Are you sad to see that summer's gone? I kind of am. It's my favorite season, but I realize it's not a lot of other people's. So, are you the type of person that feels more productive when the autumn comes? Do you get that back-to-school feeling? Do you feel like you, after a season of what you perceive as inertia, you need to be all of a sudden starting to do stuff? Or does autumn's promise of chillier weather make you want to chill? That's a question we're going to ponder while this chill song plays to open our episode.
Thank you.
we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. Well, I kind of feel all relaxed. I almost forgot to talk. That was Bombay Dub Orchestra, the electronica orchestral American band. I think they're American. I wikied them. I didn't see that they were British. I think they're American. And this song is called Monsoon Malabar from their Three Cities album back in 2008. And if you thought that the theme for today's show was going to be kind of dub reggae chill, you kind of would be right, but you would also be wrong. Because our guest artist this week has fingers and toes in many different genres, one of which is a little bit on the funkier side. As in this song that this week's guest artist handpicked to open their episode.
Dance away out of our constriction. Gonna be freaking up and down the hang up alleyway. With the groove I only got, we shall all be moved. Ready or not, here we come. Getting down.
Down just for the fuck of it. One nation and
Don't fail me now. Now, if the song before made me almost forget to talk, this song made me almost forget to stop dancing. This was One Nation Under a Groove by American funk rock band Funkadelic, fronted by George Clinton, who also had another band called Parliament. You may have heard of Parliament and Funkadelic, but Funkadelic was kind of the more psychedelic rock version of them. And this song was from their Young Soul Rebels album back in 1978, recorded two whole decades before Bombay Dub Orchestra's Monsoon Malabar. Okay, so now we have two sides of a coin. We have a funky side and we have a chill side. Bet you can't wait to see the guest artist that ties these together, because I know I can't. All right, kids, get ready, because now it's time for my favorite part of the show. Whoa, whoa. Everybody, welcome to Fish Out of Hogwarts Guest Artist of the Week! Woo-hoo! I am so excited to bring you our artist today. He has his fingers plugged into a lot of light sockets. Please welcome poet, artist, educator, activist, and more. We're going to find out. Patrick Dower!
Thank you.
So Patrick, we're going to talk about how and where we met.
That's right.
Because I ask everybody this at first.
2 years ago, I thought it was a year ago, but then I started thinking. I realized.
Yeah, it was in May of 2016 at Channel 13, PBS, right. WNET. They put out a call for entries for the show they were going to do called 66th and Broadway.
Mm-hmm. And it was, if I remember right, it was they wanted an array of artists from different disciplines,
and they wanted New York stories, New York centric material.
Yeah, and they got you, which was great.
And they got you.
Yeah.
And it was filmed in front of a live audience at Lincoln Center, and it was very fancy.
Very posh.
We had a green room and everything.
Oh my God, makeup the whole.
Yeah, band. Makeup. Yeah. And they never aired it. It's online, but it never aired.
Which made my mom so sad.
I know, mine's too. So anyway, we were performing the same night, and I remember I was there with a friend that I know from my old performance scene, Margaret Dodge, and I think you went on a couple of people before me, mm-hmm. and you did some spoken word stuff, mm-hmm. which hopefully we're going to get to hear a bit later.
All right.
And cool. I was just blown away. I was mesmerized. I was just like, this guy's so good. And then, you know, we became Facebook friends. But we haven't really seen each other in 2 years.
Which is crazy. Like I said, I can't wrap my head around time.
But we interact on Facebook all the time.
All the time. Thank God for Facebook.
Yeah. Seriously. I mean, there's a lot wrong with it. But, you know, it's good for some stuff.
Some stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, 65th and Broadway open mic.
So let me say that experience that we shared at WNET, it was great for all the reasons that you just said, but one of the things that I really appreciated is when you went on, it was that same thing of like, you know how we recognize each other? You know what I mean? Like, I never knew you.
No.
Didn't know you were on the planet.
No.
As soon as you started speaking, I was like, oh, I know her. Like, I know your story. I feel like we hung out. We speak the same language. Huh. You know what I mean? And there were so many things that you were talking about.
Well, we're both old school, though.
Yeah.
We're old school.
Brooklyn.
We're old school, yeah. Well, I grew up in the Bronx, but let's get back to Patrick.
Yes.
So you are born and raised in Brooklyn?
That's right.
Wow.
I was born in 1963, Kings County Hospital.
Is Kings County Hospital still operational?
It is.
Wow. I have so many people that were born in Brooklyn hospitals that don't exist anymore.
That's right. They closed a bunch of them down, but yeah. Kings County is a mega hospital.
Uh-huh.
And it's still there. It's raggedy as hell, but it's still there. So I was born in Kings County Hospital. And many, many years later, about 40 years later, I worked there as an art therapist. I worked with HIV-positive kids, kind of during the height of the AIDS epidemic.
Mm.
So there was something about going back to where I was born and working with young people who were, you know, sick. In the place I was born, you know, that Kings County Hospital is iconic. So,
kind of like a coming full circle type of thing.
It's like a full circle,
wow.
You know, giving back to where I was born, yeah.
Wow, giving back to where you were born. I like that saying.
Mm-hmm.
So how many generations has your family been in Brooklyn?
Two, I think. Two. My parents met in Bed-Stuy. So my mom is African-American. My dad is Irish-American. Bed-Stuy in the 50s and 60s was like a mixed neighborhood. It was, you know, a lot of Irish-American. It was working class, so it was a lot of Irish-American, a lot of Italian-American, newly immigrants, and then African-Americans coming up from the South. So my parents have a unique love story. My father being an Irish Catholic, second generation Irish guy.
Tell me he had red hair.
He didn't have red hair.
Oh,
he was what they call black Irish.
So oh,
he was,
okay.
He was dark. So, we moved to Bushwick when I was like 4 or 5, and that neighborhood then was mostly Puerto Rican.
Mm-hmm.
And he was mistaken for Puerto Rican all the time.
I'm sure.
He had Puerto Rican swag.
Just looking at you, I could just picture him walking down the street.
He was dope.
Wow. So, do you have siblings?
I have two older brothers. We have different fathers,
okay.
Like a lot of our stories.
Because I was going to ask if you had siblings from the same mom and dad, if you all came out rainbow.
No, that happens a lot though, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes. So the family that you grew up in, were they education or performance oriented? Were they artistic at all?
No, they were poor, working class. My mom was 21 and she already had two kids, and my dad, I think, was 23. He worked in a paper mill. They were
a paper mill in Brooklyn. That's right. There was a lot of manufacturing in Bushwick
and Williamsburg.
And mm-hmm.
I think he actually worked in Williamsburg first, and then he went over into the city.
Because we're talking like the late 60s, 70s.
Late 60s and 70s. Yeah. A lot of industry. Greenpoint, Williamsburg, Bushwick, they had a lot of factories.
Yeah.
And that stuff became obviously...
Well,
you can't live in those neighborhoods now. But
45 years ago.
No, it's more like 50 years ago. Yeah. I'm glad I was born when I was, because I think we were lucky to see so much change in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and we were the last generation of kids to have complete freedom as teenagers.
So. I think so.
You know,
for better or worse.
For better or worse. Yeah.
I've been slowly compiling a memoir. I got the title of it, which I want to call. Notes from an Unsupervised Childhood.
Ooh, I like that.
Because that was kind of like how I lived. You know, we ran, like you said, we ran the streets. We had all those street games and you know, just because of the way the dynamic in my family, I should say alcoholism and drug addiction is a big thing in my family too.
Mm.
So I wasn't supervised that much. And so I got to see a lot that I probably shouldn't have saw at a young age, but I'm grateful for all of it now because I had some amazing experiences. So I've been chronicling those slowly.
Were you the only artistic child in your family?
Yeah.
Did you know you wanted to be an artist from a very young age?
I didn't have language for that. I knew that I was drawn to art, but there was no reference. We had one art book in my house, I remember. It was called The History of Art, and it was a big, big book. I don't know where my dad got it from, but it was full of European art. Mm. And at the very last couple of pages of it, there was a page or two of what they call primitive art, which was African art and indigenous art. And I used to pore over that book. And I did, you know, I was always creative. I was always drawing or writing or, you know, trying to make music. But we were very poor, so that wasn't promoted as an option. Both of my parents, my father dropped out of high school, I think in his sophomore year, just like I did. And my mom dropped out but then went back to school. But they both read a lot, so there was a lot of books around. Mm. I wasn't encouraged to read, but having the books around.
But the books were there. I know that you're a multidisciplinary artist. Did you start out with visual art?
Yeah, I did. When I was 10, we moved to Flatbush. East Flatbush, and I lived walking distance to the Brooklyn Museum. And I loved art. I was drawn to it, but I never went to the museum. I would pass it, but somehow I knew that that place wasn't for people like me, so I never went there.
Did you think that a museum was a place where only white people went?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, I would watch who was going in the museum, and it wasn't me. It wasn't anybody that looked like me, at least not in the 70s.
So, did you go to a specialized high school?
No. Nah. I went to regular public school. I had one art teacher who took an interest in me in, you know, fourth or fifth grade. And I think she saw something in me. But there was, honestly, there was so much going on in my house. There was so much dysfunction in my house that I really couldn't focus on art. But
were your parents, like, breaking up at that time?
They were. My dad was drinking a lot. My mom was working really hard. My brothers were going in and out of jail. It was just a lot of shit. And
so you're the youngest?
I'm the youngest. And I was going through my own stuff too, so art wasn't like a realistic pursuit. I also got into music around that time. When I was an early teenager, my girlfriend bought me a drum set.
Wow. That's,
you know, I'm still in touch with her, and I thank her every time we speak because she did that, the trajectory of my life changed.
Wow, yeah. Why do you think that's so?
Because I gravitated immediately to it. It kept me off the streets because I was practicing. My brothers were out there doing dirt, and I was home trying to learn how to play the drums. And the drums took me to, you know, I was on stage with Sade. I played in front of Prince.
Wait a second. You became a session musician?
Absolutely. I played with Sade. I played in front of Prince.
Oh, my God. I'm genuflecting on the air right now.
Yeah. I've done a lot. I'm on one of the most popular reggae albums of all time called Dub Side of the Moon. I played drums on that as well. So
I know Dub Side of the Moon.
Yeah, that's me.
Love that.
It's a great album.
Oh, my God.
Check the credits. That's me playing the drums.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, so her giving me that drum set literally changed my life and opened all these doors for me. By the way, that Dub Side of the Moon, which is one of the most best-selling reggae albums of all time, I got $600 for it and a CD.
Wow, do you get royalties at
nope.
all? A record session musician, it's like if you do print modeling
that's
or something,
right.
You're for hire and you get paid for the thing that you do and that's it.
The music is what really got me into the city. So I left, once I got good enough on the drums and started playing.
And you're
bands,
living in Flatbush?
Teenager, living in Flatbush, which by that time was mostly West Indian. So I grew up with Rastas and West Indian. So I was heavily into reggae, which led to ska, which led to punk rock. And got me into the city. And that's where I would go to the Mud Club, CBGB's, Danceteria, Peppermint Lounge. We probably met back then, you know.
Cat Club.
Cat Club.
Tier 3.
All those spots. I was there.
Wow.
As well as Paradise Garage and the area. You know, I'm sure I met you back then, or at least saw you.
So was music your way out then?
Music and art were definitely my way out. Absolutely. And like I said, I say it all the time. It saved my life because... you know, I up until that point, I was, you know, I had dropped out of school. I was selling,
why did you drop out?
Weed. My dad died, and I thought I was a man. And I had a job, and I was hustling. And
were you in 10th grade, 11th grade?
I was in 10th grade.
Oh, man, that's not spiritual.
It's young, yeah.
16?
I got my GED, though. And I did very, very well on it. I scored really, really high. I could have gotten into college immediately, but I was hustling. And my brothers were going in and out of jail. My cousins were going in and out of jail. But it opened the door. It got me out of Flatbush. It got me out of hanging out in the street. Well, I was still hanging out in the street, but I had a purpose.
Right. It's different. This is different. You can be in the street, but not of the street.
There you go. There's another. Yeah. I'm keeping that.
En la calle, no por la calle.
I love it.
Yeah. I might have messed up my Spanish syntax there, but you know what I mean. So you never did get to go to college?
I did not go to college.
At all?
Mm-mm.
Wow. So you're a totally self-made man, as far as education goes.
You know, I always read a lot, and I still, I read like a book a week, and I always have. So I think that was a big part of it. And then I also hung out with a lot of smart people.
Mm.
And that would challenge me.
Did you hang out with mostly older people?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're trying to I get it. You want to be on their levels.
I think I always had a hunger for learning more.
Mm.
And I have to say this, college would have been a great thing. It would have been a great opportunity. It wasn't realistic to me. I had a son when I was 20, so I had to work to take care of him. No one in my family ever went to college, so it was a foreign concept. And I'll be honest, I knew a lot of people that went to college, and it didn't make them, in my opinion, any smarter.
Mm.
You know what I mean? They could say that they went to college, but they were still, to my mind, they weren't really learning that much. So I never really saw the value in it. I've been very blessed in that my life's trajectory hasn't really needed college, but I know that's rare.
But you created your trajectory.
I worked really hard.
I don't know if anybody could replicate that today.
I don't think so. I don't know.
Let's get a little bit backtrack just a tiny bit. So were you making your living as a musician?
I always had side jobs and side hustles.
Okay.
But in the mid to late 80s, that time there was a lot of happening in the city around art and music.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could hustle, like I was a studio assistant down in Soho, and like I said, I was always able to talk, and I was always able to maneuver with different types of people. So I could get myself into doors, So I was working in a pretty hip gallery in Soho.
What was the name of it?
Schiffer Gallery. It was on West Broadway.
Oh, yeah. West Broadway was just like Gallery Central.
Poppin', yeah.
I remember. It was popping. I went to the School of Visual Arts. I was there in the early 80s. And we used to do what we used to call being so hopeless. Mm. We would go and try to sneak into as many openings as we could.
Get free wine.
Get free wine. Get the crudité.
Hell yeah.
Because that was the big thing. No one ate like raw vegetables.
What? I remember standing next to Basquiat at Mud Club and thinking, yo, this dude is mad corny. Like, I'll be dead honest. I was thinking I should rob this cat because it was obvious he had some money, and I just thought he was really, really corny.
But did you do things like that?
Oh, yeah.
You robbed people?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, shit.
I did a lot of dirt. I did not like
in
doing
my life.
It, but I did it. And then I also should say that, drugs and alcohol also played a big part of my
story. Oh, so you were using it when you were young?
Yeah, yeah. And I got sober when I was 38, thank God, but because it almost killed me, but I think that also, you don't make good decisions when you're high.
No.
No. You don't make healthy decisions.
No.
And I spend most of that time high, so or on my way to
get high. What was your drug of choice?
I drank a lot, but I was a garbage head. Like whatever I could get my hands on was all fair play.
Wow. I can't picture you being that way.
Yeah,
at you right now, and you just seem to be the picture of health. Bursting with vitality and strength and spiritual and centeredness.
Yeah, I got sober. I did a 12-step program. It's been 17 years that I've been clean and sober. But up until that point, I had to hit a really, really bad bottom. Like a lot of us do.
When you got sober, was that the end of your music career?
No, I did Dub Side of the Moon after that. I got sober in 2001, and I think we did that the following year. So, it didn't at all. Mm-mm.
When did you segue into visual art, or were you doing visual art all along?
I was doing visual art all along, but not taking it very seriously.
Were you self-taught?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, totally. All of what I do, I'm self-taught.
What were your artistic influences, would you say, for both visual art? I mean, we know that for music, it's the dub and the reggae and rock
punk,
and punk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All that stuff.
But for visual art, who were your influences? Did you like Basquiat?
Yeah.
Or did you think he was like...
I can't believe you were going to... Yeah, I was totally going to rob his ass because he was corny to me. A lot of those guys, that, I don't know, man, I was coming from a different place, and maybe it was envy, but I later respected what he was able to do. And our stories are really a lot similar. I think he's also from East Flatbush.
Mm. I remember seeing his tags in SVA, Samo.
Samo.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Or Samo.
Yep.
So he wasn't really influenced actively early on. I was more into like the older artists like Romeo Bearden and Charles White, a lot of the older African American artists. I was influenced by, but I wasn't really studying anybody that much, you know.
You were just doing your thing.
I was kind of doing my thing. Yeah, a lot of the graffiti stuff too.
Were you a writer?
I was a terrible writer.
Oh, I was terrible too. I did it, but I was so bad. I was so toy.
I was so toy.
I was more toy. I'm going to win this one because I was the toy.
You were really super toy.
I was super toy.
But I was trash too. But years later, I worked with young people, and I was directing a program director of a mural organization called Groundswell. So we did, you know, hundreds of murals around the city, and I would always talk to the kids and tell them the story of me and my graffiti writing.
Oh, what was your tag?
I had two. So I had Wars 1, so it read Warzone.
Oh, okay.
And then...
Because War was a crew, was Writers Are Respected.
I know. So I put Z on, it was Wars.
Oh.
And then Wars 1, so it read Warzone. Mm. And then I had one, God Body, which is I still hold on to.
Oh, that you still have that as a hashtag for your social post.
But I was Shell. Terrible. Shell,
S-H-E-L-L.
That makes sense, because
my teenage nickname. Yeah, that
makes sense.
So what was the turning point for you becoming more of who you are now? Because the Patrick that I know, I see you're like an artist, educator, and activist. So when did you get into teaching? When did you get into that work?
That was random. I was working. I used to take kind of any kind of job I could get. Mm-hmm. Right.
Like name some of them.
Oh, I've done every. I was a security guard. I was a construction worker. I worked as a secretary.
Secretary.
I did anything I could get. I'm grateful because with all of those different kind of jobs, I picked up, you know, another skill. Like, you know what I mean? I learned how to maneuver. I learned how to deal with people from different walks of life, and I learned, you know, different skills. But I literally that was a different world too. I would get jobs by referral. So a friend would say, hey, I'm working at the museum, man. You should apply. I'll get you in there. And so I was working as a curator's assistant at the Museum of African Art. I had no skills. I just, you know.
But you were working as curator?
Yeah, assistant.
Assistant curator.
Yeah, yeah. But I learned a lot.
Were you bringing up your son at this time? Were you with his mom's?
No, I wasn't with his mom, but I had him on weekends whenever I could. He's always been in my life. He's my best friend now. And I always paid child support. This is why I always had to work. So I took a lot of different jobs. I guess in the mid-90s, I was working in an art store in Park Slope on 7th Avenue and 12th Street.
Oh, yeah, that place, it was a big one.
That's
and
right.
Now they only have the framing part.
That's right. It used to be framing and art supplies. So Mario Romo, God bless him, who was like a mentor to me, he hired me. He saw something in me and hired me, and he had me managing the art store. And one day this woman came in and said, hey, you're really great. You should think about teaching art to young people because you relate well to people. And I was like, I bet there's some extra money. And so I started doing that freelance.
Where?
First out of Brooklyn College, then with studio in the school, and then a bunch of little arts, Brooklyn Arts Council, those small, like, kind of free. So they would send me into schools in Brownsville, East New York, Bed-Stuy that didn't have art programs, and I would kind of act as the art teacher for a couple of months or, you know, for a project. And I did that through the 90s. So again, I had no schooling. I used to wing it.
Do that now. Now they want you to have master's degrees and all kinds of stuff.
But that started me on that trajectory, though.
Wow. Do you think that you influenced any child then?
I hope I did.
And like made an artist out of them?
I hope I did. I mean, that was a long time ago. Those kids are adults now.
Well, yeah, those kids would be pushing 40 now.
Probably, in the 30s or 40s, Later on, when I became the program director of Groundswell, which is about 6 years ago now, 7 years ago, those kids were older, and I've been able to be in touch with some of them, and some of them, they're practicing artists. They're pursuing their dreams of the art. We helped them get into art school. And, you know, some of those kids are doing amazing. I'm not taking any credit for that, but I think it is important for young people of color, young people from financially disadvantaged background who had upbringings similar to mine, to see like a successful person of color doing mm-hmm. art.
Yeah.
It can be done.
Yes. I totally believe in exactly that too, that mm-hmm. the kids need to see that this is a viable
yep.
life choice.
Yep.
But you know, you also need to know the realities of what you need to do to sustain it.
That's right.
You know, that you need to have some kind of day job unless you marry a lawyer.
Yeah.
You know, but there are ways to do it, and it can be done.
You know, there's a lot. I used to have to talk to parents a lot, especially parents of immigrant kids. Because, you know, the immigrants' parents are like, my kids are not going to be artists. I didn't, like, struggle to come to this country so that my kid can be an artist. They got to be a lawyer or a doctor. And so I would have to often talk to them about, like, the idea of being an artist is just not as simple as somebody in a studio in a smock all day. There's tons of different ways you can pursue an art career. You know this. They could be graphic designers. They can work in art administration. There's tons of things that they can do.
You could be a sound engineer. You could be a makeup artist.
Absolutely.
You can be a set designer.
There's tons of things that they can do that are still creative and will make them a good living. So I used to have a lot of conversations around, you know.
Because they don't know. They don't know. I've interviewed many first generation people, immigrant parents, you know, from the Caribbean and from other countries. And basically, artists are dirty. Artists are sucio.
They're degenerate. Yeah,
yeah, they're degenerate. Mm-hmm. You know, they're hooers.
Mm-hmm. They're hooers.
they don't pay their rent.
They don't pay. Yeah. They're drug addicts. They don't make any money. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that starving artist thing is a real thing. So I get
we're breaking that. We're dispelling that stereotype right now that artists can be sane, artists can be sober, artists can be whole, artists can be healthy, artists can be...
They can be
we
people,
can be,
that, and not only that, we can be people that didn't come from privileged backgrounds. I think that's super important, you know, at least in my story. But I feel like this probably applies to you too. I don't have a choice, and I never did. If I think about my life, everything I did was gearing me to be an artist and a musician. Like I had no choice, you know.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I'd work on a construction spot and. Take, you know, during my lunch break, I would take pieces of the wood that we just broken up and try to make a sculpture out of it. Like, I have no choice. So
yeah, it's part of you.
It's
you're
part
driven.
Of me.
You
yeah.
have to do it. If you don't do it, you die.
Yeah.
That's the whole reason why you're alive, is to make something so that someone knows you were here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally. I have something to say. That's the thing. Like,
yeah.
I don't think it's as conscious as me being like, I need to create this because I need to let you know I was here. I just have to do it. It's impulsive. You know, and I think that same obsessive and compulsive piece of me that, drove me to drugs and alcohol, I've channeled that into creativity.
And you were doing artistic things all through you're using years.
Yeah, yeah. I actually, you know, I fell into that stupid belief that drugs and alcohol make you a better artist. You know, Basquiat fell into that. A lot of artists and musicians did. We fell into this thing that, because, you know, a lot of the heroes that are propped up, especially musicians, the Hendrix and the musicians that I looked up to had habits.
And for writers, it's drinking.
It's drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bukowski was my man.
Oh, my God. So after you became sober, did you notice any changes in your art or the way that you approached art?
Yeah. I mean, I got better.
In what way? Technically better or creatively better?
Both. Technically, creatively, more driven, more organized. Everything in my life got better when I got clean and sober. But the art that I created when I was using, it was expression, but it was, you know, I couldn't fully focus on the art because I had an addiction to feed. So once you remove that part and you can start seeing clearly and focusing, the art got much, much better. Everything got better.
So what mediums do you do for your visual art now? And I noticed that you do a lot of collage.
I do a lot of collage, and that came out of, working in offices, because I had to work, that had Xerox machines.
Oh, yeah. So use that day job.
Do that, man. That's
right.
Free Xeroxes.
Hell yeah.
Also, that was the time when a lot of punk rock art and even hip-hop art, we were using a lot of Xeroxes, right,
mm-hmm.
to create, like, images. Subversive images and stuff. So it came a lot out of punk rock, but also just having access to Xerox machines. So free art supplies. So I always made a lot of collages with Xerox machines. I still do Xerox collages. A lot of the art that I do now, the sculptural stuff, is from found objects on the street, like flattened cans and pieces of rusted metal. And that also came out of necessity. When I got sober, I was homeless, and a friend of mine let me stay in his recording studio in Greenpoint. And next to that studio, there was a metal foundry or metal recycling yard, and there was just tons of, like, flattened metal and rusted metal laying around. And I started thinking, like, oh, I can do something with that. Like, I don't have enough money to buy canvases right now, but I can probably do something with this stuff on the street.
So what did you make, like, found object sculptures?
I started making sculptures based on African art because I had some background when I worked at that museum. So just using pieces of rusted metal from the street and then flattened cans, using them as a canvas to put Xerox copies on.
Were you showing at this point?
Nah.
Never?
Mm-mm.
Just making it at home and keeping
it
at home?
Just had to make it.
Do you have all your art that you've ever made, or did it just, like...
I sold a lot, though.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't necessarily showing in, like, galleries, but I, I've been really blessed. Like, people have always gravitated to what I've done.
So they've been collecting you?
Yeah, there have been some people that have, like...
Since when?
Since I got sober, for sure.
So since the early 2000s?
Mm-hmm. And I didn't call myself an artist until last year.
Really?
No. I would never claim that. People would say, oh, you're an artist? And I would be like, no, I do art. I'm not an artist.
Why is that?
Because to my mind, an artist was somebody that went to school for art. An artist was someone that was worthy of that title. And I wasn't.
What?
Yeah. Only this last year did I claim it.
Wow.
And that was through some real, like, self-examination where I was like, nah, man, my life is proven that I'm an artist. So
yeah, your whole life
is. Why don't I own that?
Yeah. Lately, you've been an arts administrator?
Yeah.
How did you segue into that? Because you worked for BRIC for a while, right?
I did BRIC in an interim position as the director of education at BRIC. It was an amazing experience. And I left there last month. And before that, I was 6 years at Groundswell, which is, I think it's considered New York's premier community mural arts organization. Mm. And that made a huge impact. And we worked with big city organizations and Rikers and detention centers. And again, that was one of those things where I showed up, the opportunity arose, I knew somebody who was working at Groundswell. I had been doing youth work, and they were like, you know, I think you'd be good in this position. You should interview. And I had no qualifications on paper,
right.
You know, but I had life qualifications, yeah.
But you just made your own way, and you forged your own path.
I showed up. God did it for me. I just showed up, yeah.
And sometimes El Señor puts you in a place, and you bloom where you planted.
And and so I take credit for showing up and doing the work, but there's been a lot that has been like, things have lined up for me just so wonderfully that I'd be foolish not to think there aren't higher, you know, purposes at work.
I totally believe that. I see the hand of El Señor in my life many, 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 many times.
Absolutely.
It's there. It's so there. So the other part that you do is writing. What have mm-hmm. you been doing with that over the years?
So I've written poetry. I've written music. I put out an album in the early 2000s of my own stuff. And I've been working on my own short stories that will eventually, hopefully, be sort of a memoir. But there are factual stories that came from my life and the characters that I met and things that I did. But then there's also like some kind of creative, funny short stories that I've been putting together. And then like I have done some poetry.
Wow. Well, a little Pascal says that you're going to share one of these little stories with us.
I'll do the poem.
Okay, yeah, do a poem.
Because I feel like everything we've been saying has been stories.
That's true.
Telling
That's
stories.
True. So, That's true.
I'll do that poem that I did on WNET.
Oh, great.
I mean, I've done a bunch of poetry, but I like that poem because it feels like it fits in with what we've been talking about with New York. And I think any time that I talk to native New Yorkers that are from our era and have similar experiences, there's a sentiment that we share, which is like a sadness that the city isn't what it was. Anyway, so the poem is, first came the hipsters to tame the land, to pacify the natives, the original man. And then the settlers and homesteaders brought the cavalry to stop and frisk me, making it safe for the yuppies. And now I don't recognize the block where I was born. They came from places with backyards and big lawns like West Bubblefuck, Michigan and Okie-Dokie, Wisconsin, moving in like they slumming. They keep coming. Now my culture been rezoned. My house ain't my house and my home ain't my home no more. They brought in their money and moved out the poor. They raised up the rent and changed the locks on my door. And now I ain't welcome in the corner store no more. Yo, on my block, Ock, what the fuck? We got a yoga spot, pet grooming, and Starbucks. And since when did the so-called ghetto get trendy? They're making me homeless and smiling all friendly. They're smiling your face, and all the time they want to take your place. Gentrifier is a liar who will conspire to take your home, your earth, wind, and fire, and you wondering why your rent's raising higher and higher? Because these are the days of the gentrifier. Gentrifier got this thing on lock. My home, my zone, my hood, my block. Gentrifier, in complete control. Steal your land, steal your style, steal your street, steal your soul. Gentrifier got this thing on lock. My home, my zone, my hood, my block. Gentrifier, in complete control. Steal your land, steal your style, steal your street. Hey, yo, I don't know what the Jeffersons was talking about, but we ain't moving on up. We getting moved on out, no doubt. You see, to them, it's monopoly. All they want is your property. Shit, I should have bought Park Place, but now it's too late. This used to be the ghetto, now it's prime real estate. And where the hell am I supposed to go? I can't afford their co-ops, I can't afford their condos. Yo, they're doing us like they did the Native Americans, except this time they didn't set aside reservations. Fixing up the block in the train station, building high-rises is gentrification. All the little mom-and-pop shops bought by big corporations with no vibes or flavors or connections to the community is gentrification. And my whole damn hood is looking like colonization. Less brown skin and more white skin is gentrification. Now they look at me with scorn on the block where I was born. It happened so fast, didn't see it coming on. And now there's new maps, new lines being drawn. But these are the days of the gentrifier. Gentrifier got this thing on lock. My home, my zone, my hood, my block. Gentrifier in complete control. Steal your land, steal your style, steal your street, steal your soul. Gentrifier got this thing on lock. My home, my zone, my hood, my block. Gentrifier in complete control. Steal your land, steal your style, steal your street. Stole my soul. Yeah.
Snap. Did you ever do that at the New Eureka Poets Cafe? Do you perform?
I have performed it. I have, yeah. But New Eureka, I'm so intimidated by that place.
Really?
Yeah, man.
Why?
I've seen so many amazing performances over there that, like, I can't get
up. Do you do open mics and stuff?
I've done some open mics, but always, like, kind of like, you know, I've been on stages, like I said, I've performed with big names. I've been all over the country.
As a musician.
Something about doing the spoken word makes me so nervous.
Oh, okay. I get it.
Yeah.
What are you up to these days?
When I had that realization that I'm an artist, right?
Last year.
I was like, if I'm an artist, then I got to do art. I'm going to pursue this full time. And that's what I've been doing. And things are starting to come together, you know?
Well, I just saw a social post where you... Are we allowed to talk about the
Ava
Day?
Yeah, please.
Okay. You sold one of your paintings to Ava Day.
No, I didn't sell it to her. They want to use it for, I hope she buys it, but they want to use it for her new Netflix documentary.
On the Central Park Five.
On the Central Park Five, which is a case that, you know, is very dear to me. It means a lot to me. They found me. I didn't reach out to them. Somebody at
Netflix. Is that
Netflix,
something? They found me
and they liked that piece. So we did a little negotiation. So they'll be using that for the documentary. But I have people that have been collecting my work, so my bills have been getting paid, and I've been very disciplined.
Are you going to have an art show anytime soon?
I got a couple of lined up. One, I believe, in October,
great,
Philly, and then one in San Francisco at
fantastic,
the Museum of African Diaspora.
So I aspire to own one of your artworks.
Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah, after the show.
You got to have one.
After the show.
Yeah,
after
you
the
need
show.
To have one.
If people want to find out more about you and your fabulousness, where can they do so?
This is another amazing thing. All the years that I've been doing art, never had a website until last month. So it's www.godbodyart.com. And then on Instagram, it's my name, Patrick Doerr.
Are you on Twitter?
I am not on Twitter.
Okay.
I got enough distractions.
But you're on Facebook.
I'm on Facebook.
Okay, so like him on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
Like him on Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
Buy his art.
Yeah, yeah.
Buy his art.
Say a prayer for me.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, many, you
for us.
So, Patrick, if I always ask this question of everybody when we come to the end of our chat together. If you had any advice or encouragement to give to a child in your situation mm-hmm. when you were young that knew they had a burning desire to be more than the world around them gave them the right to want to aspire to be.
Mm.
What would you tell this child?
I would tell them that they can do it, that they absolutely have the right to do it, that they're worthy of it, that they should know that it's not going to be easy. We've got to be twice as good to get half as far. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything, but it can be done, and they deserve it. And moreover, you're needed. Your voice, your valuable, precious, important voice is needed. So never edit yourself. Never second-guess your vision. But know that it's not going to be easy. We live in a society where, unfortunately, we don't get the same breaks as other folks. But that doesn't mean that we can't make our own opportunities. So do it. Just do it. Like, don't look behind. Just keep going forward.
Leap and the net will appear.
That is on my refrigerator, and I look at it every morning.
Because if it was easy, everyone would do it.
That's right.
You are a wise man, sir, and I am so glad that mm-hmm. you were on the show.
I'm so glad to know you.
Hug on the air!
Give me a hug!
Mm. We always end with a hug on the air.
That's important.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. Your valuable, precious, important voice is needed. And that word of wisdom from Patrick Doerr, artist, multi-everything, leads us to this announcement that Radio Free Brooklyn is proud to announce we've been partially funded to start an after-school program for local teenagers in 2019. This program will teach Brooklyn area teens about media and media making using a hands-on approach guided by local radio and journalism professionals. Each teen will create their own radio show, which will air on Radio Free Brooklyn on a new dedicated stream. Sounds great, right? Except we still have a long way to go to make this program a reality. Please help us make this program happen by going to radiofreebrooklyn.org/afterschool and donating what you can. Each donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent of the law, and you'll have the fuzzy warm feels from knowing you've helped the next gen of radio broadcasters and journalists get a head start. Well, we're going to close our show with the song that Patrick played drums on with the Easy Star All-Stars. It's the dub reggae version of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, called Dub Side of the Moon. How cool is that? It came out in 2003, and this song is Us and Them. Stay tuned for Brooklyn Bandstand next, and we'll see you next week. Woohoo!
Mm-hmm.